through April 15 on KBOO Portland. You can check it out at kboo.fm/ATNF4 and listen online to shows you might have missed for Black History Month, International Women's Day, Mardi Gras Rock and Roll, and other musical marathons. Remember, too, that KBOO is only on the air because of support from listeners like you. I'm going to leave you today with a song by La Santa Cecilia called Ice El Hielo, about living in constant fear of deportation. Thanks for listening and stay active. Our resistance is all we can count on.
Ice, water frozen solid. ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE, El Hielo.
Eva pasando el trapo sobre la mesa y está cuidando que todo brille como una perla. Cuando llegue la patrona, que no se vuelva a quejar. No sea cosa que la acuse de ilegal.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. From its founding, KBOO's purpose has been to serve as a community-driven alternative to mainstream media. In a new year, with numerous executive orders from a new presidential administration and the rise of misinformation, KBOO affirms its duty to serve its community. KBOO, its programmers, volunteers, and staff do this by bringing you accurate information, by giving space to underrepresented voices, and by uplifting arts and culture. In these uncertain times, KBOO seeks to be a guiding light for those who are scared, those who are affected, and those who are fighting the good fight. KBOO stands with the immigrant community, the LGBTQIA+ community, the disability community, and all of those affected by the new administration. We stand here at 90.7 FM in Portland, 104.3 FM in the Corvallis-Philomath area, 91.9 FM in Hood River, and at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we start, I want to remind you that KBOO is funded by you, the listener. So please show your support for this amazing community resource during our All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 membership drive by making a contribution today, or better yet, become a monthly sustaining member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. More than three decades ago, urban naturalist Mike Howe coined the term greenfrastructure to describe the important role that urban green spaces play in providing climate resilience. Green infrastructure emphasizes the importance of viewing our parks, forests, wetlands, and even parking strips as critical infrastructure in the same way we view sanitation, sewage, waterworks, bridges, and roads. Today we talk with Mike about how, in the face of climate change, we have to once again embrace green infrastructure, particularly if we want to adapt to the climate crisis. Mike, welcome back to Luck is Focus.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, I was pulling that term green infrastructure out of the recesses of my brain, but I remember you first talking about it, and I think I heard that term before I heard green infrastructure. So I want to talk a little bit about where that term came from in the turmoil, the catacombs of your brain, and what it's really about.
The catacombs of my brain. Green infrastructure. Yeah, I was trying to be cute, basically. It was back in the days, we're talking actually almost 40 years ago, green infrastructure really was not a term that people used at that time. My first introduction to the concept actually came with a fabulous book that Anne Whiston Spurn wrote in 1984, The Granite Garden, in which she said the belief that the city is an entity apart from nature and even antithetical to it has dominated the way in which the city is perceived. She says the city must be recognized as part of nature and designed accordingly. And it's taken a long time to get the powers that be to actually start thinking of integrating nature in the city. Although, again, the concept goes back even further. 1903, John Charles Olmsted was brought here by the Portland Park Board, the volunteers, to write a master plan for Portland Parks. And in that, he said parks should embrace streams that carry at times more water than can be taken care of by drain pipes of ordinary size. Thus, brooks or little rivers, which would otherwise become nuisances that would someday have to be put in large underground conduits at great public expense, may be made the occasion for delightful local pleasure grounds or attractive parkways. So 122 years ago, he was prescient. He saw what we would do today.
And actually, that's something that the city of Portland really didn't start doing until maybe the last 30 years.
Yeah.
I think about all those creeks. I mean, actually, I remember talking to you many years ago about you and your friends going into basements and down sewer holes, some things, to find the hidden creeks that are under the streets of Portland.
Yeah. Yeah. Metro produced a map called the Disappearing Streams Map, and it showed all of those streams that are now underground, unfortunately.
I mean, a big one, I think, that became the most notorious was Brooklyn Creek. And people, right. I think people don't know the names of all the other creeks in Southeast Portland, but Brooklyn Creek has survived, maybe because there's a neighborhood named after it.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about what Brooklyn Creek was and how you can maybe see that as a future. I mean, I used to have fantasies about daylighting Brooklyn Creek, actually.
Uh-huh.
But I'm wondering if we could talk about what it was, the relationship it had to the landscape, and how it sort of became a model for some of the green infrastructure restoration that happened starting about 20 years ago. Or more, 50, I guess it's almost 30 years ago now.
Well, I'm actually not familiar with that stream, other than the fact that we tried to find it.
Well, it goes from Mount Tabor to the river.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it goes down, I think it goes down Hawthorne, between Hawthorne and Division. And during the flood in 96, I have friends who live right off of Hawthorne and around Cesar Chavez. They had really flooded basements and really flooded backyards, lost all their lilac bushes.
Right.
And that was because Brooklyn Creek was rising.
Yeah. Well, you know, the best example I can think of regarding trying to incorporate a healthy stream and reduce flooding is Johnson Creek out in Foster floodplain. I don't remember the year now, 2014. I'll have to look that up. But as you know, and most Portlanders know, Foster Boulevard was routinely flooded every time it rained. And the City Bureau of Environmental Services, in its watershed health program, actually went into that 63 acres roughly, and using FEMA money, which we hope we continue to have access to, bought out. Willing sellers bought out the folks who were repeatedly flooded and restored an active floodplain that greatly reduced flooding, hardly ever floods now. So that's a local example of a very successful effort.
Actually, you're bringing back my early memories of being in Portland in the early 70s, and it was kind of a seasonal thing. Foster Road is underwater again.
Right.
And it was about, started in the 90s up to about
111th, basically, yeah. In that area, right across the street from Beggar Stick Marsh.
Which is now a natural area that's been preserved. So, I mean, there's several things. Zenger Farm also got developed at that time, and they did some wetland development.
Right. In fact, BES, I believe, is involved in yet another project east of Beggar Stick and north of the Foster Floodplain Project.
So it seems like besides abating flooding, it also has been creating these wonderful natural areas.
Well, that's the beauty of green infrastructure. You know, you put water, stormwater, say, in a pipe, it has one function and one function only, and that's to get water out of there, right? And it's out of sight, out of mind. With something like Foster Floodplains, which Portland Parks actually manages, so it was a cooperative effort between BES, the Bureau of Environmental Services, and Portland Parks, you have multiple benefits. And in fact, that's when green infrastructure as a concept and to be used by the utilities, Bureau of Environmental Services, Unified Sewerage Agency, no, Clean Water Services, sorry, in the Tualatin. The whole concept of multi-objective management came into being in 1990 when we brought experts from around the country, Association of State Floodplain Managers, wetland managers, to give us examples from around the country of where, rather than using riprap, rather than only relying on gray infrastructure, you get access to nature, you get carbon sequestration, you get all kinds of benefits, you reduce urban heat island. So you get multiple benefits every time you use green infrastructure.
Well, I think this show was kind of birthed at a Rumble on the River I saw you at a few months ago. That was actually about the Portland Clean Energy Fund.
Right.
But you started talking to me about this whole thing about climate resilience and that we really needed to be taking this very, very seriously. And you're saying to me, climate resilience is more than planting trees.
Yes.
And you started talking about another place that used to flood every year, which is Crystal Springs, where it was goes under Bybee Boulevard in a culvert, or it used to, and that intersection on Bybee was just underwater for several weeks during the year. Let's talk about what happened there, because that was a place you wanted to talk about, actually. And in fact, I have a photograph of the park that's there now as the photograph of the show, inspired by your description.
Well, yeah, the Crystal Springs, the Westmoreland Restoration is a fabulous, fabulous example, an award-winning example, by the way. The American Society of Landscape Architects and others have recognized both the original Westmoreland Restoration, and then later there were additional projects around Crystal Springs that I just learned about from Caitlin Lovell, who works for the Bureau of Environmental Services, also received an award. And basically what happened there was there were two big concrete pools, one of which was for fly fishing, fly casting. I know it was used in the winter for ice skating, and of course there were a lot of waterfowl there. The city, Bureau of Environmental Services, working with the local neighborhood, actually, there was a very active neighborhood group, Bureau of Environmental Services and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, removed one of those huge concrete containments and reformed Crystal Springs Creek. And the amazing thing, well, first of all, greatly increased wildlife habitat. It's a fabulous area for wildlife habitat.
One thing about Crystal Springs through that area that struck me when I first saw it was it's like a miniature L.A. river. I mean, it was paved underneath it.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the things, besides having this casting pond, and I think they also had milk carton boat races in that pond.
Right, right.
But besides that, just having this whole river paved, that couldn't be very good.
Well, so folks who are listening may not be aware that Crystal Springs Creek emerges on the Reed College campus. And the critical thing there is the water is cold year round. And so what was amazing about the restoration project, while the late beloved Nick Fish, the Corps of Engineers, the tribes, the neighborhood were all there in 2014 celebrating the culmination of that first phase of the project, literally, I don't know, 100, 150 feet away, there were salmon spawning. During the heat dome, I don't remember which year now, when I know I was on the Willamette River, and there were hundreds of turkey vultures all along the banks of the Willamette feeding on dead salmon that had all gone belly up due to the temperature of the water. Crystal Springs Creek was a beautiful cold water refugium for salmonids.
Let's describe, because it was more than just taking the pavement out of the river, but also they changed the course of the river.
Correct. They re-meandered the stream, exactly.
And then there's all this planting.
Yep.
It's basically been turned into a wetland.
Yep. It's awesome. A good riparian and wetland habitat, yeah.
It's also interesting, there's less goose poop there than there used to be.
Well,
as a dog walker, I mean, I used to take my dog to Westmoreland Park, and I just couldn't stand it because it was just covered with goose poop. And now, I guess it's hidden, but it seems like the area is better for everybody, including the geese.
Yeah, actually, I used to go there mainly to see if I could find a Eurasian widgeon back in the 70s and early 80s. There's not nearly the amount of waterfowl there, and by virtue of them not being there, you don't see a lot of droppings.
So they're not as much waterfowl because the current wetland is not
the
as...
vegetation change, yeah. Yeah.
So they're all back in Oaks Bottom where they belong anyway.
Yeah, they're still around.
What also did that do for the neighborhood? Because it's not just this wonderful wetland, but there's also like a playground in there that's kind of
Well, the nature play area is fabulous.
Yeah.
It's probably a risk management specialist's greatest nightmare to have these things that kids are climbing on. But it's fabulous nature play.
Because I think about what happened there this is 2014, I guess, when this is all started.
Yeah, 2014, and I think it went through to 2019, actually.
Because many years before that, the beach and what became a park at this just north of the Sowood Bridge, and it became Sowood Riverfront Park. And one of my biggest complaints about that park was that there's a really nice natural area, but most of that park is this grassy bowl,
yep,
which is basically a mosh pit in the winter. And now it's a dog park. It's a nice dog park when you're not up to your knees in mud. And I had wondered at the time why they hadn't turned the whole park into a native plant area, just like a natural area. And I was told by people who work for the Parks Department, it's not safe.
Well, golly. Yeah, Sowood Riverfront Park is a good example. And I'll have to say that I walked it with a friend of mine who was a wetland ecologist for EPA, Ralph Rogers, with landscape architect Marlene Salon. This is way back when it was literally a huge mound of mill leavings of sawdust covered by Himalayan blackberry. So if you look at what it was versus what it is now, you still think it's fabulous. There could have been more native plantings there. One of the things we did manage to talk Marlene and Portland Parks to do was create a pretty nice little water feature there that kids can go dip for polywogs or whatever. So, you know, there is an effort afoot actually in Portland Parks and Recreation to take some of the grassy areas in some of the parks and actually renature them. So that effort is ongoing for developed parks.
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, KBFG LPFM, KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. We're during our All Frills, No Frills Volume 4 Special Programming Campaign that's going on now through April. Tune in to our Bluegrass Special on Saturday, March 29th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. and our Stand-Up Comic Special on Monday, March 31st from 10 to 11 p.m. And check out these specials and more at kboo.fm/ATNF4. And today we're talking with Portland urban naturalist Mike Hauk about how in the face of climate change we have to embrace green infrastructure if we want to adapt to the climate crisis. It used to be that Portland prided itself on its green infrastructure and as being a leader around the world in incorporating green infrastructure into city planning. But what happened?
Well, we've had a little retrogression, actually. Portland really got on the green infrastructure bandwagon back in the early 90s. We brought experts from around the world. The power of the outside expert cannot be overemphasized. The first was David Good, who was director of the London Ecology Unit. And to give you an example of how important it is to bring in folks from the outside, David Good didn't say anything differently before City Club. We managed to get him on the City Club docket. than I and others had been arguing for many years. But he was more than 100 miles away, and he had a British accent. And I actually had people come up to me after his City Club talk, who I hadn't been able to get the time of day from. Won't mention names, but somebody from the Oregon Community Foundation grabbed me by the arm, literally, and said, "We have to do in Portland what they're doing in London." And I just smiled, bit my tongue, and said, "We'll get right on it." And what came out of bringing David, the Association of State Floodplain Managers, wetland managers, the experts around the country, was that elected officials, Earl Blumenauer, eventually Nick Fish, who was a very great advocate, Sam Adams. I mean, Adams, when he was mayor, actually allocated $55 million to the Greater Green Project. So we had a lot of local leadership who really got behind the notion that using green infrastructure produce, again, those multiple benefits. And in fact, it also saves money. Bureau of Environmental Services did a study on a little sub-basin to the Willamette River, the Tabor to the River study, and concluded that by using bioswales, by using other green infrastructure techniques, planting trees, etc., the city would actually save $63 million to deal with stormwater in that little sub-basin of the Willamette River. So it's cost-effective as well.
Actually, I want to get back to Tabor to the River again, because that was a very interesting and kind of charismatic program when it started. And that's the program that follows the path of Brooklyn Creek.
Ah.
And the swales that went in that are on either side of Hawthorne, basically, from Mount Tabor all the way down to, almost all the way down to the river, I think down to 7th and Clay is the furthest west swale, are actually, it's interesting, the river, the Brooklyn Creek, I guess, can't be daylighted. It's not practical. It's my fantasy. Have gondolas going down Hawthorne instead of
right.
cars. But at least the swales kind of give a small part of that mechanism back that a natural river or natural creekside would have. And I wonder if that was sort of the plan of kind of recreating, however the best we could, the natural services that Brooklyn Creek once provided.
Exactly, ecosystem services, right? You get more than just putting a pipe under the ground. I will say that the very first bioswale that I'm remembering, I thought it was in Northeast Portland for sure. I can't remember which street now. But after it went in, other neighborhoods started lobbying the city to put bioswales in their neighborhood because they were so attractive and they enjoyed them so much.
It's interesting. I had an argument with a friend who lives right off of Division and up in the 30s, and she was hating the bioswales because they were taking away parking. So that was the other mentality. He had a kind of fight. On the other hand, I live on a block in Selwood where there's now a stop sign at the end of our street, and there's a stop sign at the end of another street. There's three streets coming together. But it was a really dangerous intersection, and we were trying to get the city to put a bioswale in there, and we were told we were really low priority.
Well, another example of multiple benefits, traffic calming, absolutely. And I would say that you posed the question, why have we regressed? I was actually hopeful we would have somebody from the city on today who would have much more familiarity with specifics, or somebody who worked for the city. I will say I did contact the folks at the Green Roof Information Think Tank, GRIT, that has some folks who used to work, including Tom Lipton, who actually created the EcoRoof program for the city of Portland. And while green roofs are still on the city's codes, apparently there's very little activity going on right now. In fact, they removed the requirement for eco-roofs in downtown, and one of GRIT's recommendations is to reapply those requirements.
Why did they remove them? Is this the home builders?
Politics.
Yeah.
Politics.
I want to kind of talk about this little shift in the Seawind that has really transformed Portland from being an environmental leader to being kind of an environmental slaggard.
Yeah.
But that I think about all the requirements that we had that you were involved in getting instituted in the 90s and in the early aughts. And it seems like they've been dismantled by for various reasons. And I want to talk a bit about the political forces that have been at play. What changed politically that made it possible, for instance, to remove green roofs from being required for any downtown building?
Priorities have shifted, obviously. Homelessness is a huge issue. You know, post-COVID is a huge issue. Natural resources, environmental issues have kind of slid off the table. But I think we have an opportunity right now presented to us to re-energize the city around ecological green infrastructure, response to climate change. We have a new city council. We're talking about really restructuring the city of Portland. One of the things I think needs to happen, and I've made a recommendation to the Climate Resilience and Parks Committee of the City Council. There are a numerous different committees, including infrastructure, is that we need, I think, to create a single bureau. I would call it the Bureau of Natural Resources. I know there's interest through the blue-green proposal that city staff has come up with to consolidate the bureaus that deal with natural resources, Bureau of Environmental Services, parks, water, et cetera, into one bureau that has responsibility rather than having silos. And I think there's some receptivity within the city to go that direction.
Well, it used to be in the good old days under different leadership that the Bureau of Environmental Services was in fact the Bureau of Environmental Services and did a lot of major work. I mean, particularly as a resident in Selwood living right near Oaks Bottom, that was the restoration of Oaks Bottom. A lot of Bureau of Environmental Services dollars went into fixing that. And was seen, what I really love, particularly talking to Dean Marriott, who was the director there for a number of years, and we would talk about the importance of, for instance, saving the hillside above McAdam on the west side of the river, where the cemetery is, and preserving that whole area as forest land, basically. And that was as important to the sanitation infrastructure as putting in pipes. And that
more
was,
important.
Right, actually, more, I agree. And I felt like there was this period where BES really appreciated that and was putting a lot of money into buying property, for instance. And then the Portland Business Alliance and their allies kind of started all these lawsuits. And I wonder how much impact that had on really pulling back BES's role as environmental services.
Oh, I remember that era. that, of course, leads me to think about Bob Salinger. I have to say, I miss not sitting here with him.
He should be sitting right across from me right now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the city was sued, and the allegation was they were using stormwater fees for issues not central to the mission of Bureau of Environmental Services. Thankfully, for Bob's efforts and the local unions, that was basically push back that, in fact, the judge ruled that most of what the Bureau of Environmental Services was doing, including the acquisition of that Riverview Cemetery property, which became a new park, natural area, was absolutely legal under their mission. And I would mention, by the way, that had that area been developed, which was absolutely conceivable, that would have resulted in the lack of flow of cold water into the Willamette River at that site, which has provided yet another but natural cold water refugium for salmonids. There was a pitch battle that generally got beat back.
Except that I used to see a lot of BES presence in Oaks Bottom, and they were basically maintaining it for years.
Right.
They're not there anymore. It's back to Parks, and BES used to do a lot of hand weeding.
Yep.
And now Parks is there spraying their glyphosates and stuff like that.
Well, I've actually been a supporter of the limited strategic use of herbicides in Oaks Bottom because, having been a volunteer back in the early 80s, trying to remove the tsunami of black human land blackberry over the trail was impossible using volunteers. The Bureau of Environmental Services is still somewhat involved, and this actually brings up my point about a Natural Resources Bureau. Yes, Portland Parks owns Oaks Bottom, is responsible for managing. BES's revegetation team had worked for numerous years with Mark Wilson, who worked for Portland Parks, to remove non-native vegetation, which, by the way, is also critically important for fire hazard reduction. And in fact, that's another case where the city used FEMA money to try to, after the big fire at University of Portland, to reduce the amount of non-native, very flammable vegetation. So yeah, I think what we need is a bureau that brings all of the folks in the reveg team with the folks in Portland Parks under a Natural Resource Bureau to work together, rather than having two bureaus that have to communicate with one another. And of course, that slows things down. And I think there's a matter of economies of scale, too, frankly.
Well, I'm also thinking about a change of mindset that we're dealing with the consequences of that. A number of years ago, I was interviewing then Mayor Sam Adams for a documentary I was doing about urban watersheds. And I mentioned to him that I saw the streets of Portland kind of as tributaries to the Willamette. And his face lit up, and I said, "Well, you say that."
Yes.
And he did.
Yeah.
And he said it very forcefully. And it was really different having a mayor who could visualize that. I missed that Sam Adams. I don't know where he went, but he's not around anymore, unfortunately.
Oh, he's around.
I mean, I'm not agreeing with him very much anymore.
Yeah.
But I think that to have a mayor who was so visionary back then really set the tone. And we have not had a mayor like that since.
No comment. Yeah, he was a leader, as was, as I said, Nick Fish is a city commissioner. Well, that brings up cities, or the streets being as streams?
Tributaries.
Tributaries. That's a good point, because I think the real heyday of green infrastructure came about during the effort to create the Big Pipe project, which Portland was sued for all this because of all the sewage going directly via stormwater into the Willamette River and the Columbia Slough. That was a $1.4 billion project. The neat thing about the process we went through with the Big Pipe was we got serious about talking about integrating green infrastructure with that effort. So it was gray and green. And by virtue of eventually convincing EPA, they were very skeptical at the beginning, but we eventually convinced EPA to allow the city to integrate green infrastructure, which resulted in a reduction in the diameter of that pipe, which costs much less money. And overall, the Big Pipe project highlighted green infrastructure in the city and again demonstrated you can reduce costs of managing stormwater by using green infrastructure.
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KVFG, LPFM, and KODIX, LPFM, KMUN and KCB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And we're in our All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4 special programming campaign. It's going on now through April 1st. Tune in to our Bluegrass special on Saturday, March 29th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. and our stand-up comics special on Monday, March 31st from 10 to 11 p.m. And you can check out these specials and more at kboo.fm/ATNF4.
Can I inject actually, something here?
Yeah, actually, before you do that, because before I forget this question I was going to ask you.
Okay.
What were the aspects of the green infrastructure that were integrated into the Big Pipe?
Well, it was called the Cornerstone Projects, as I recall. Well, first of all, there was downspout disconnect, which is a very simple thing. You take your downspout, disconnect, let it infiltrate into the ground, and it doesn't get into the system. So you reduce the overall amount of water that's going into that system that results in the overflows.
And BES gave you a discount on your bill for doing that.
Correct. So then you've got, obviously, tree plant. And I don't want to denigrate tree planting. It's critically important. My only gripe about tree planting is when we talk about adaptation to climate, it tends to focus only on the negative impacts on human health. And of course, we know we have urban heat islands that resulted in many deaths during the heat dome. We need to address that. We need to plant trees in areas that that lack trees, and that happens to be in areas where low-income communities, people of color. So that definitely needs to happen. But there are many other elements of green infrastructure than simply planting trees.
And we'll get into that in a moment.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the other thing that you wanted to...
And bioswales...
Wait, was there anything else besides the disconnecting your downspouts?
Well, bioswales, tree planting, as I said. Yeah, very important. Anybody who walks around Portland knows, just walking on the sidewalks when it starts raining, all of a sudden you come to a dry spot. Why is that? Well, there's a tree canopy overhead. So increasing the urban forest canopy overall is really important.
But I understand that the urban forest canopy has actually shrunk in the last 10 years.
It has. And that is another huge issue we need to address. There are issues related to the tree code. There was a very critical article recently in Willamette Week. There are many sides to that story. I would agree that we need to address homeowners' concerns about the costs and so forth, but we need tweaks. We don't need to get rid of the tree code, and we don't need to stop planting and expanding the urban forest canopy.
Well, another issue that Bob Salinger would bring up constantly was dealing with the critical energy infrastructure hub and the industrial sanctuaries in Portland and how they're exempt from tree codes.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about that. Is that part of the plan to get tree codes into the places that they are exempt right now?
Yeah, exactly. We need to expand into the industrial areas, absolutely.
And so then what else did you want to tell me before I interrupted you?
Well, no, I just wanted to get to climate change, because I think green infrastructure is, you know, the most critical tool that we can use to address climate change. And one of my gripes, I was on the Planning and Sustainability Commission for 11 years. We adopted a climate action plan while I was on the commission, which is great. It took, I don't know, 2 or 3 years of really banging heads to get a climate preparation strategy. I use the word adaptation. And there's an interesting little anecdote I'll share to show you how weird the political world can be. I went back to Philadelphia with a group of folks from the Bureau of Environmental Service and the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And during the conversation with folks from around the country, it came to light that the word adaptation was not one some jurisdictions wanted to use, especially maybe in the South or in a little more conservative areas of the country, because adaptation sounded a little too Darwinian.
What does that mean? Because you put that in one of your notes.
Well,
to me.
The religious right, Darwin, evolution.
Oh, so it sounds like the idea of evolution.
Yes. Believe it or not, that was the rationale. At any rate, for whatever reason, the city of Portland also chose to use climate preparation strategies, which is fine. The climate preparation strategy, however, kind of went by the wayside. And even though elements of it were integrated into the most recent climate plan, the climate strategy has been lost. And one of the things that we need to do is, and this is a recommendation I made to city councilors the other day, is that I think we need to adopt, city council needs to adopt a climate adaptation policy. The emphasis of that should be using what I would call nature-based solutions or green infrastructure.
So what would that look like?
Well, it would be using the natural landscape, for example, to reduce urban heat island, to protect biodiversity, mainly to fight against the increases in temperature.
Well, one of the things that's been concerning me for maybe the last 10 or 15 years is as Portland is infilling to try to deal as its own self-image of how to deal with increasing population without expanding further into non-urban areas,
right.
That a lot of this building is going on close in Portland is, I think, creating heat islands. It's antithetical to a lot of what you're describing. And it's one of the things, for instance, like we're so far away from having green roofs, we're having actually black roofs, which just absorb heat and just create heat islands. It's black-sided buildings. There's no room. The buildings go right up to the sidewalk. There's no right. room for any kind of natural spaces between the building and the sidewalk and the parking strip. There are trees going in. I've been noticing that with all the new development in my neighborhood that there's more trees being planted than there were maybe 30 years ago. But it seems that the Home Builders Association and the developers have got the way of basically cutting through a lot of regulations or cutting out regulations that are seen as costing too much for them, which basically are just reducing their gargantuan profits and are really harmful to the neighborhoods that they're building in.
Well, very timely question or observation. Actually, last Monday, there was a 23rd annual urban ecology and conservation symposium at which Ted Labbe, who while he was director at the Urban Green Spaces Institute, while I had a brief retirement, I'm back now, is working with the Nature Conservancy and others around the region to develop recommendations on urban forest canopy expansion that addresses that very problem. I know that Ted and others are working on trying to revise tree policies across the region that addresses the need to densify to allow for more infill, but simultaneously retain or increase the urban forest canopy. It can be done. Unfortunately, right now it's viewed as an either-or, which we need to address.
Well, that's one of the problems is that we've seen that at the state legislative level. We're seeing that with our governor, that we can't both improve the environment and build more housing. We have to do one or the other. And I know Bob Salinger was like, you know, on that. Bob is gone, so it's up to you now, Mike. You
Bull.
And the crony. Okay.
I won't do the second part of that.
So how can we argue that?
Well, we can argue it because people want that. One of the big resistances to infill and increased housing is loss of green spaces, including neighborhood trees. So we have to do both, and we can if we do a better job of designing and incorporating vegetation, trees, shrubs into the landscape.
But it also seems that we have to deal with the political forces,
yes,
and the financial forces that have been decimating the environmental requirements.
That's right. I just had a conversation with somebody yesterday who is part of the family that reacquired to the family the Bishop's Close. He's interested in creating a climate adaptation center institute, a think tank, to bring people together from the business community and the environmental community and jurisdictions and government to try to figure out how we do that.
Bringing up the Bishop's Close is kind of an interesting thought because that's also a very pivotal environmental sanctuary in a way. And when it sounded like it was going to be gone.
Right.
It was a real concern that they had to develop that area up on the cliffs above the Willamette River. So let's just talk a bit about why a place like the Bishop's Close is so important to preserve and how that can sort of spread its light outward.
Well, I'll give full credit to Peter Platt. He's the one in the family, founder and owner of Andina, who is talking to many people. I've been his yenta in some respects in that I've introduced him to so many people like Bob and Soil Water Conservation District, more recently, a good friend, Jonathan Nicholas and Noah Siegel, who we met yesterday, to talk about forming this, what would it be called, an institute or whatever. It's the oldest private garden in the region. And basically, Peter's idea, and in working with people like Vivek Chandas at Portland State University, who's done a lot of pioneering work on urban heat island, to use it actually as a demonstration site over time, but also a gathering place to bring together folks who want to explore how we bring the business community, the conservation community, and government together and use that as a site. Plus, it's just a wonderful area. So imagining getting out, you know, don't meet downtown. Although we want people to come downtown. I'm not saying don't come downtown. I want to make that clear. It's just a really pleasant place for people to be able to just wander around and think the big thoughts and get together and come up with new strategies.
And on a rainy day, they have that really nice house. There's a really nice house on
the property. Oh, beautiful.
So that could be a great center for an institute.
Yes, well, Peter actually already has the Hardy Plant Society, has offices there, and he's interested in bringing nonprofits who are in the botanical biz, but also people such as myself who are, you know, working for nonprofit conservation groups together and have offices there, as a matter of fact. So both a meeting place, but a gathering place for like-minded people who are working on these issues.
So is the Bishop's Close open to the public still?
Yeah, it is. Yes.
I'm going to have to go there again.
Oh,
soon.
It's beautiful.
I love it. It's one of my favorite places.
It overlooks Elk Rock Island. It's fabulous.
Well, I'll let people know that you're listening to Locus Focus on KVU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Seattle stations KVFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And we're in our All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 special programming campaign going on now through April 1st, or going through the month of April. Tune into our Bluegrass special on Saturday, March 29th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and our stand-up comics special on Monday, March 31st from 10 to 11 p.m. Check out these specials and more at kboo.fm/ATNF4.
I want to go back to your question about the climate preparation strategy, by the way. I'll just read one quote, just as one example of the recommendations. Identify habitat diversity and connectivity needs, such as links to among existing natural areas or anchor locations. Prioritize habitat corridors for protection enhancement, including acquisition, restoration, regulations, and innovative techniques such as vegetated streets to create an interconnected network of terrestrial and aquatic habitats. And I'll give you an example of my favorite opportunity, Ross Island. I got involved with Oaks Bottom back in 1970, 52 years ago. Fortunately, through a long process, we got Oaks Bottom recognized and managed as a urban wildlife refuge. We have the opportunity now, today, via our efforts to deal with climate adaptation, to create a 700-acre natural area if we combine Ross Island, actually the four island archipelago, Ross, Hardtack, Toe, and East, with the Holgate Channel of the Willamette River and Oaks Bottom. We need to acquire Ross Island. We need to figure out how to manage it, whether that's the city of Portland or Metro or a combination, or the state, the Department of State Lands is a possibility, or all of those collectively. We have to do that. And that would be a direct response to climate change. We know there are algal blooms, toxic algal blooms coming out of the lagoon. We need to address that, but we need to address it in the larger context of that potential 700-acre refuge, wildlife refuge.
So that's 700 acres in addition to the 170 acres that's already existing.
No, that's all combined.
Includes the existing 170-acre Oaks Bottom.
That's an example of addressing climate change through adaptation by protecting existing natural areas and improving them.
Well, thinking about another Bob Salinger legacy, because this came up at a Rumble on the River this past week about the Port of Portland and how to deal with them. And somebody was talking about how they were going to develop West Haden Island? And I said, I don't think so.
No.
I wanted to know what.
No.
Now, so I know that.
The nail is in that coffin.
Okay, good. I told him.
Dead.
That's what I told him. But I also know that when you were speaking at Metro Council in memory of Bob right after he died, that you talked about the need for Metro to basically create the Bob Salinger Memorial Park.
Yes.
At West Haden Island. And I'm wondering what's happening with that.
Well, I have heard via many grapevines that Metro and the port may be getting close. I just got a spate of emails from folks expressing a huge amount of concern over the acquisition of a site on West Haden Island for mitigation that would be required vis-a-vis the new bridge. And people are very concerned about that. I think that...
What does that mean? What would mitigation mean?
Well, they're going to need to address the fact that they're going to have negative impacts on potentially on marine mammals and so forth. I don't know the details, other than that there is an area that can be used to mitigate for the bridge project. That's a level of my understanding. That may provide some funding that might go toward Metro acquiring West Haden Island. So I think that's a distinct possibility. I'm hopeful that we can use similar techniques to get Ross Island.
Well, I remember mentioning last time you were on the show about how August 1st was Bob Salinger's birthday. Maybe that could be a deadline for both of these projects.
Ah, I like it.
It's coming up. I mean, it's only 5 months,
yeah,
4 months
like
away.
Okay. Yeah, who knows?
Well, Mike, push for that.
Who knows? I know we're definitely interested in talking with Metro Council. They've got a big pot of money that they just used, $10 million of which, to remove a dam at Kellogg Creek in Milwaukee. I'm going to be advocating that if they got $10 million, which I definitely support, if they've got that big a fund, they ought to be using that money for acquisition and or restoration on Ross Island. I will mention one more thing. We were talking earlier about bringing outside experts to the City of Portland, starting back with the Country and the City Symposia. There is what's known as the C40. It's a global network that was started by the 100 largest cities in the world. The City of Portland is a member of that global network. I am hopeful that Mayor Wilson will continue Portland's membership in that. And we have Colombia, Singapore, Paris, Quezon in the Philippines are all, what I have been told, are cities that we now should be looking to. And I'm hopeful that we will remain in the C40 and bring folks from those cities to Portland to show us what they've done as an example. Because I think we do, once again, have the need for outside leadership to Portland.
Well, in the last few moments, one of the things I'd like to do with you is to revisualize downtown Portland. Which, you know, there's a lot of talk about redeveloping downtown and, you know, bit the dust during the pandemic. I mean, actually, I've been down there a lot. I think it doesn't look that different than it did before. So they put a lot of new buildings in.
Yeah.
But there's some stuff that happened in the last 20 years in downtown Portland, particularly the north of the Pearl District or the north end of the Pearl District, which has some connection to nature.
Oh, yeah.
And I wonder if you see ways to make downtown Portland more like that vision that John Charles Olmsted had of, you know, the creeks and the brooks rippling through urban areas.
Well, you mentioned the Pearl District. I think one of the most wonderful elements of Portland Park system is the triptych that's in the Pearl District. You've got Jameson Square, Tanner Springs Nature Park, and the Fields. There's supposed to be yet another park on the Willamette River that I'm hopeful will come to fruition. But I think of Tanner Springs as one of my favorite parks. Even though it's one city block, Herbert Dreisaitl and the local firm Greenworks, Mike Fea and Mike Abate and those, they couldn't daylight Tanner Creek, unfortunately, because it was too far below grade level. But they did recreate a semblance or something evocative of what was there in the past. And a week after the dedication, I was driving up Northwest 10th, and this thing flashed across my windshield of my car, and I leaped out, and a woman was standing there, mouth agape, and there was an osprey that had landed in the little pond and caught a koi, and was sitting there eating a koi. And I got a picture of the osprey and sent the image to Herbert Dreisaitl in Germany and said, you just had the biggest compliment to your park you could ever imagine. So yeah, we can do more of that sort of work, even in the central city.
Because actually that's another series of parks that kind of replicates the course of a underground creek, which is Tanner Creek.
Yeah, you have the open water at Jameson, and you've got the pond and the spring at Tanner.
So I think, do you see any other parts of downtown Portland where that could happen, or maybe even rethinking the park blocks that go through downtown itself?
Well, there again, I think eco-roofs will come in as a really important feature in downtown to create greening. And if you look at Singapore and some of these other cities I reference, you know, green buildings are not just don't just have eco-roofs. They actually are covered in shrubs and so forth. So that's something that we should be thinking about.
And that was actually starting to happen maybe 15 years ago.
Yep.
So besides getting outside experts into Portland to kind of recharge our batteries, do you have any other thoughts about how to get people in Portland maybe more active in visualizing what they'd like to see the city develop into?
Wow. I think there's a need. Back in 1994, we created the Coalition for a Livable Future that brought housing advocates, transportation advocates, the Urban League, Albina Ministerial Alliance of Black Churches, Jobs with Justice. I think we need to recreate something of that nature that would be a driving force to do that, but to include the business community, which we really didn't do as much as we should have maybe back in the early 90s. I think pulling together a more innovative group of folks, such as the quote think tank that I referenced at the Bishop's Close, to work together so it's not an either or again. It's not a zero sum proposition that we can have a vibrant downtown, we can have a vibrant city that integrates nature into the city much more holistically than we're doing at this moment in time.
Well, I'm hoping sometime later this spring we'll have somebody from the city join us here.
I think that'd be great.
So we'll work on that for maybe sometime in May. I don't remember the dates that you said people were available. But.
Yeah, no, I think that'd be great because, as I said, I admit that I'm not really up on the nitty-gritty, really fine-grain work that's going on in the city right now.
Well, Mike, it's great having you on. I'm glad you could add what you know already. So thanks for being on Locus Focus.
Well, thank you.
We've been talking with Portland urban naturalist Mike Houck, and you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM, KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff and volunteers who continue to do an incredible job of making KBOO the important community resource that it is. And you can help us by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member during All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 Special Programming Campaign, going on now through April. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Tune into our Bluegrass special on Saturday, March 29th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., our stand-up comics special on Monday, March 31st from 10 to 11 p.m., and check out these specials and more at kboo.fm/ATNF4. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. And thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with environmental lawyers Sky Walker and Kelsey Elberly about the lawsuit filed against Northwest Natural's devious practices by its customers. We'll go out with music by Abby Lincoln. My engineer is Ray Bodwell. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and keep active and fight the power.
It's an action of repeat, active doing, active saying something bitter, something sweet. Acts of light that keep occurring, ghosts appearing through the sound, waving at us from the distance, 'cause the whole wide world.
This is Daniela from STEM Champ. You're listening to KBOO Portland.